Members of the court, my name is Robert Atkins. I represent the appellant Viacom International. We're here today, I think, because the single largest issue that was submitted, debated, and argued on the merits for resolution by the resolution accountants was left undecided. And that was because the resolution accountants refused to decide it, about which they were straightforward about, and because Viacom, we submit, was denied a full and fair opportunity to present its evidence and to be heard. The result of that was a $200 million overstatement and miscalculation of the earnout by the resolution accountants. What should have, in our view, been a $100 million earnout ballooned into a $300 million earnout because the number one issue that the stockholder representative himself put into dispute, what to do with and how to treat the enormous cost of unsold inventory, was left unresolved. Specifically, I'm referring to the fact that the evidence that Viacom submitted showing that the impaired value of that unsold inventory needed to be written down, that the cost of this useless and unsellable unsold product needed to be deducted from revenue. That evidence was submitted in direct response to the stockholder representative's central position about the central issue in dispute, and that is that the so-called matching method of accounting should be used to resolve the unsold inventory issue. Now, Viacom's position, as was very clear throughout the entire proceeding in here, was that matching was not required by the party's agreement. But Viacom was equally clear that if they were wrong and that matching accounting was going to be used to resolve the inventory write-down dispute, then matching requires that the lost value of the unsold goods had to be deducted from current revenue to calculate gross profit. And I would point out that at no point, including today, is that a disputed proposition, namely that matching accounting requires that if in fact there is obsolete or unsellable inventory or inventory that cannot be sold at market price, then matching requires that the cost of writing down that inventory be charged against current revenues. Now, in the face of that evidence and that dispute, did the stockholder representative object that the inventory write-down was outside the scope of the proceeding? Did he protest that it was non-arbitrable? Did he claim that it was not properly presented or out of bounds? Absolutely not. The stockholder representative briefed it and argued it on the merits without a word or a hint or a sigh of protest about its arbitrability. And I submit that is because it was the stockholder representative himself who put at issue in the first place the question of what to do with the unsold inventory. And it was the stockholder's representative who proposed the matching method of accounting to answer that question. Therefore, on the date of the hearing in this case, on the date of the resolution accounting proceeding, indeed, at the end of that day, after argument, the parties had joined issue on the merits of the inventory write-down. The parties had submitted it for resolution by the resolution accountants. And as I said, at that point, there was not a word from the stockholders' representative that the inventory write-down was non-arbitrable. In fact, the stockholder representative did argue that other issues that he claimed Viacom had belatedly or improperly raised were out of bounds, were arbitrable. And you can see that at page A423 of the record, which is the party's briefing to the resolution accountants. He objected that certain additional items of cost that Viacom had raised in its briefing were belated, were brought up too late, and were beyond the bounds of the proceeding. But he did not raise any objection as to the inventory write-down.
Now, the way you put all of that makes it sound like we should be shocked to find out that as a result, the arbitrator didn't consider the issue. What's your understanding of the reason that it was not considered?
Well, my understanding of what the resolution accounting did was that there were a set of items, including the inventory write-down, that he viewed as being in dispute between the parties as to whether they were properly presented. He said the parties have differing views as to whether they're properly before him. He asked the parties whether or not there was agreement as to which of those issues he could and couldn't decide. He did not ask whether they were arbitrable. He did not ask whether they had been raised in the earn-out statement or the summary of issues. He asked a simple question. Do you folks agree I can decide A, B, and C? And, of course, not surprisingly, we didn't agree as to A, B, and C. The stockholders' representative took that opportunity to say, really at the 13th hour, we object to the inventory write-down. And what the resolution accountant did, in my view, was said, I'm a creature of consent. I only do what you guys agree I can do. And therefore, I'm not going to decide any of those issues, including the inventory write-down, where the two of you don't agree that I can. He then, of course, concluded his opinion by saying he was prepared to reach the question of whether, one, it was arbitrable, whether it was within the scope of the proceeding, or he was happy and prepared to reach the merits of that. He didn't do either of those two things. He didn't decide whether it was arbitrable, and of course we all know he didn't reach the merits. Almost more importantly, as a matter of law, whether or not the resolution accountant himself determined the arbitrability question, it is our view, and I think the law is clear, that he didn't have the power to do so. That, flowing from this court's decision in Willie Gary, followed up by the line of Court of Chancery decisions, starting with Nash and HDS and Avnet, the law is clear that where a question of contract interpretation is involved in deciding the gateway question of what's in and what's out of either accounting proceeding or arbitrable proceeding, that contract interpretation question is a question of law, and questions of law that go to the scope of the proceeding are not to be decided even by full-blown arbitrators, and certainly not in the case of limited use, limited authority accountants who, at least, and in our case, our agreement not only said explicitly in Section 2.4 A and B that the resolution accountants were limited to determining the disputes and recalculating the earn-out, it went on to explicitly state that the resolution accountants are experts in accounting and not arbitrators. So on the question of whether these parties intended clearly and unmistakably, as Willie Gary requires, for the issue of arbitrability, that is, the legal question of the scope of the proceeding, to be decided on the court on the one hand and the resolution accounts on the other, I don't think there can be any doubt as a matter of law that that issue resides with the court.
Let me make sure. Obviously, earlier I used the word arbitrator because I was, in my own mind, thinking the resolution accountants serve as an arbitrator in this situation. Maybe that's not, based on what you just said, the same thing as acting as an arbitrator in the traditional sense or the federal statute sense. Would you tell me, is there a substantive difference between the two?
On the question of, yes, there is, when it comes to the question of who gets to decide questions of arbitrability or the scope of a proceeding. It doesn't matter with respect to the applicability of the Federal Arbitration Act, which has been read to apply very broadly to all sorts of alternative dispute resolution proceedings. But on the issue of is arbitrability arbitrable, the law is clear in this state under Willie Gary that you need two things. Well, the test is there has to be a clear and unmistakable intent by the parties to vest in the arbitrator or alternative dispute resolver the authority to decide questions of arbitrability. And that can only be established by two things. One, the invocation or reference to the AAA rules of arbitration, and in addition to that, an all-encompassing, all-inclusive, all-purpose arbitration clause for resolving all disputes. This case, I believe, resides at a great distance from that. Not only did we not invoke the AAA rules, not only is there no all-purpose arbitration provision, the dispute resolution provision says explicitly the scope of authority of the resolution accountants is limited to determining the earn-out issue and recalculating the earn-out issue, and then goes on to say in the very same sentence, and the resolution accountants will be treated as experts, not as arbitrators. Taking that all together, I think it's clear and unmistakable that the parties never intended for the resolution accountants to be making rulings of law with regard to interpreting the merger agreement as to the scope of the proceedings and as to whether certain issues were in or out.
Regardless of the language about if a court tells me to or if you agree upon it, I'll decide this. Effectively, didn't the resolution accountants decide that the inventory write-down was outside the scope of the issues presented?
I think that ultimately the holding, if you will, that final paragraph is what governs and what should govern us. I do agree that it went through analysis, and I don't deny that it appears that the resolution accountants were of the view that the inventory write-down needed to be included in Viacom's earn-out statement. I mean, clearly, they or he went through that analysis. Nonetheless, at the end of the day, what he held or decided was, I'm not going to resolve the parties' differing views as to what's in and what's out. I'm just going to decide what you tell me you've agreed on. And if you want to tell me yourself or you want to give me a court order, then you come back and I will decide whether or not the inventory write-down is arbitrable and or I'll decide the merits of it. So I think that my view is that he didn't actually reach that. I understand there's different ways to read that. And at the end of the day, I think what matters most for this appeal is that as a matter of law, he couldn't decide that because the parties never clearly and unmistakably agreed to give him the authority to interpret the agreement and reach legal conclusions about what was properly submitted or not properly submitted.
I'm a little confused about how that argument responds to the opinion, which is the basis of your appeal. As I understand it, the trial judge held that the issue of the write-down, the inventory write-down, could have been the substance of arbitration, would have been the substance of arbitration had it been raised at the right time and in the right document, but it wasn't, and therefore it was waived. What am I missing here?
You're not missing anything because that argument didn't go to it. I was answering a different question. The reason I believe that determination is reversible error is because I believe the Court of Chancery misinterpreted the contract, in fact, misinterpreted two contracts, in holding that their inventory write-down had not been properly submitted. That's an error of law. It's an error of contract interpretation. It's subject to de novo review. And frankly, I think the court below got it wrong, and I think in two respects. The court effectively found that since Viacom hadn't included this inventory write-down number in its original calculation, that somehow Viacom was prohibited from addressing it thereafter. And that, I believe, contradicts two agreements, both the agreement between the parties and the resolution accountants, the engagement agreement, and it violates, I believe, the merger agreement between the parties. First, as to the engagement agreement, and this you'll find at A137 through 150 of the appendix. The engagement agreement is explicit that this was not to be what I think the court below turned it into, which was a baseball arbitration. The agreement between the parties and the resolution accountants is explicit that the resolution accountant need not decide this on the basis of either party's positions. Let me read this to you if you would permit me. It says, Mr. Pagola, the accountant, will make his determination as to each item in dispute, which may differ from the positions of both parties. It may differ from the position of both parties. It goes on to say that he can make that determination, which may differ from the position of both parties, on the basis of the parties' initial and reply submissions. Those are the substantive evidentiary submissions, and the argument made during the hearing. Nowhere did the parties agree, either in the engagement agreement or in the merger agreement amongst themselves, that they were prohibited from presenting evidence or arguments, A, to rebut each other's positions, or B, to help the resolution accountants make their own independent determination and calculation. In fact, it strikes me as something of a contractual contradiction to find, on the one hand, that the parties entered into an express agreement to give the resolution accountants authority to recalculate the earnout on a basis different from the number that Viacom put in that initial earnout statement, which was so critical to this decision below, yet also find that the resolution accountants were forbidden from considering evidence and arguments from the parties to make that independent recalculation. So basically, what we find ourselves in the position where there's a clear agreement that the resolution accountant, as an expert, can bring to bear arguments and evidence presented by the party and reach a decision that differs from the opening positions of the party. But this party, Viacom, was prohibited from presenting evidence and arguments to the resolution accountant to allow him to get to that determination. And I think that contradiction is resolved by the fact that that wasn't the party's agreement, and that's reflected in the merger agreement, which set forth the design and scheme for this dispute resolution process. And respectfully, I think the court below inverted the architecture and design of that process. The court below effectively required that Viacom submit its responses to the stockholder representative's positions before the stockholder representative ever discloses or discusses its positions. Indeed, before the earnout disagreement even commences. That's not what the parties agreed. In fact, that's backwards from what the parties agreed. And let me explain. The way the contract provides for this process, and this is sections 2.4 A and B of the merger agreement, A16 and 17 of the record. The process begins with Viacom submitting a statement setting forth a calculation of the earnout payment. That's the earnout statement that the court below focused on so heavily. It's a calculation. It's not an argument. It's not a pleading. It's not a brief. It's certainly not a rebuttal submission. It's a calculation. And at that point, there are no disagreements. The dispute only arises if the stockholder representative disagrees with the calculation. If he disagrees with the calculation under those same provisions, then he must submit what is called the summary of issues. That's the document that is the focus of our briefs here. That summary of issues is the document that contains, for the first time, a written description of each disagreement. That document, that summary of issues, that's the opening pleading. That's the complaint in the matter. That's the trigger of the dispute. And as the stockholder representative himself framed it, that, the summary of issues, is the controlling document. And it's the summary of issues prepared by the stockholder's representative and delivered to Viacom that put into dispute for the first time, both the issue of how to account for the unsold inventory, number one, and number two, the use of matching as the accounting method for resolving that issue. It's plain, it's clear, it's on the face of the summary of issues. It's in the record at A112 in simple, plain English. The stockholder representative said that the cost of inventory cannot be deducted when calculating product gross profit. That's the unsold inventory issue. It goes on to say that in order to be deductible, the cost must relate to the products that generated revenue. That's matching. Now, they argued that the summary of issues, the admittedly controlling document, did not raise matching. With all respect, I think that's an insincere argument. It didn't use the word matching, but in every subsequent submission and argument, they described their accounting method as matching. And it is under matching, which in fact the resolution accountants embraced and applied, it's under matching that the impaired value of the unsold inventory needed to be deducted in order to accurately calculate the gross profit.
I know it's late in your argument,
yes.
But I have a question. I haven't heard anything, I think, so far about the idea that it doesn't matter whether the resolution accountants got it right or got it wrong, or in fact what they relied on or didn't rely on, because the scheme here was an arbitration-type proceeding, and that's a final decision. It's reviewable for things like fraud, not for mistakes.
We're proceeding under FAA 10A3, which is the provision that permits the court to vacate awards, arbitration awards, where pertinent and material evidence is not heard, where the arbitrator or ADR figure refuses to hear pertinent and material evidence. So we're proceeding under FAA 10A3. And the case law, both from the first, Fifth, and Second Circuit, make absolutely clear that under that provision, no fraud or misconduct or mischievousness is required, but rather there has to be established that the failure to hear evidence resulted in a failure to have a full and fair hearing that prejudiced one of the parties.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
I do.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is David Schiffman, and I represent the stockholders' representative, Walter Winchell. I think there are five propositions that both sides agree upon. First, both sides agree that this is an arbitration under the Federal Arbitration Act. Second, both sides agree that the resolution accountant's mission was to determine the earn-out payment amount, that was an issue that was for them to decide under the Federal Arbitration Act. Third, we both agree that under the express terms of the contract, the merger agreement, that the resolution accountants were to determine the earnout solely on the basis of the earnout disagreements. That's a defined term, but that they could only consider earnout disagreements when rendering a decision as to the earnout payment amount. Fourth, Viacom has conceded that it did not ask for an inventory write-down deduction in its earn-out statement. It could have, and it chose not to. And fifth, Viacom also conceded in the court below that in the schedules that it presented to accompany its earn-out statement, it asserted facts that were inconsistent with the existence of an inventory write-down. And I want to talk about that for a minute. Because when Viacom prepared its earnout statement for 2008, it faced a dilemma. And the dilemma concerned this inventory of unsold Rock Band video games at the end of 2008. And the question was whether Viacom was going to maintain as a factual matter that the market value of this inventory was less than what it cost to manufacture the games, or in shorthand, whether the inventory was impaired. And the reason that Viacom faced a dilemma was that it had taken contradictory positions in the past. In a prior and preliminary calculation that it provided to Mr. Winchell, Viacom said that the inventory was impaired to the tune of $54 million. Now, Your Honors, if that were true, if an inventory write-down of $54 million was called for at the end of 2008, then it would have been reflected in Viacom's financial statements and would have been a $54 million hit to its operating income for 2008. The problem is it wasn't in Viacom's financial statements for 2008, not in the audited financials and not in the 10-K. So Viacom had to decide when it was preparing its earnout statement for this proceeding whether it was going to take a factual position that was flat out inconsistent with its audited financial statements and its 10-K. And Viacom made a calculated decision that it wasn't going to go that route. And so it gave us an earn-out statement that did not include an inventory write-down, that included a schedule for inventory, and that schedule actually had a line item for the amount of write-down on the Rock Band video games, and the amount shown there was zero. So Viacom, as a factual matter, was saying, we're not contending that the market value of the inventory was below cost. So when did Viacom change its tune? Well, the next significant event was when we engaged the resolution accountants, because the engagement letter specified what issues the resolution accountants were being asked to decide and what procedures we were going to be using. Viacom did not say a single word that it was going to raise an issue about the market value of the inventory.
Help me understand when your side comes back and says that, in effect, that the matching method of accounting should be used, what can be presented in response to that? Is it just yes, no, or can there be a detail as to if it's used, it has to be used correctly? What is the permissible response?
Well, first, we did not talk about matching in our summary of issues.
Okay. Hypothetically, if you have.
Okay. They could come back and argue for a different interpretation of the contract. They could not come back and argue for different facts.
Well, could they argue to correct a math error?
It's not a math error.
Well, hypothetically, could they argue to correct a math error?
I don't believe so. In fact, we were told by Viacom that we couldn't do that because what the resolution accountants called the parties' other disagreements, which they concluded were not earn-out disagreements, included six new deductions that Viacom wanted. But on our side, for three of the specific disputes that we raised, we subsequently said we think the amount in dispute should be higher, that there are more dollars at stake than we originally asked for. And the resolution accountant said, you know, we're concerned about whether you're allowed to ask for more money in dispute, just as we're concerned that about Viacom raising these new issues. What do you two sides have to say about this? And Viacom said that the merger agreement doesn't allow us to change the dollar amount for a dispute that we had already put on the table. So Viacom's position was you couldn't correct that either, that the issues are defined by the earn-out disagreements. Now, we never talked about matching in our summary of issues, which is the pleading, which is what defines things. Mr. Atkins read it correctly. What we said was, in order to be deductible in a year, the direct variable costs must relate to the same products that generated the net revenue during that year. And if you accept our argument, it would preclude, and it did preclude, not only Viacom's attempt to deduct all of the inventory at the end of the year, but to deduct the portion of the inventory that it was writing off. I mean, Viacom is suggesting that we came forward with an interpretation of the contract which says, yes, they are allowed to deduct inventory, but that's not true. We said, no, you're not allowed to deduct any costs that do not pertain to the products that were sold during the year. So you can't deduct the unsold inventory, and you can't write off the unsold inventory. So this is not a situation where we put forward an interpretation of the contract in our summary of issues that says, yes, you can have an inventory write-down deduction. But let's suppose we did. Even if that were true, Viacom is not allowed to come forward after we've submitted the issues to the resolution accountants and say we want to present new facts. I know we told you before that there is no inventory write-down deduction based on the facts. But now we want to present evidence that the market value of this inventory was $54 million below cost. You can't do that under the terms of the agreement, and that's what the resolution accountant said. But let me just take it one step further here. Viacom's argument is that when we submitted the summary of issues, we put on the table the question of whether an inventory write-down deduction should be permitted. But when Viacom presented its opening submission to the arbitrators, didn't argue for an inventory write-down deduction. It wasn't there. You'd think that for an issue that's worth $191 million, that if we put it on the table, that would be front and center in their opening submission. And it wasn't until their reply submission, at the very end of the proceeding, that they raised the factual question, for the first time, is this inventory worth less, have a market value that's less than its cost? Hadn't raised that factual question before.
Well, let's assume all of that is accurately stated. What's your position on the actual scope of the resolution and accountant's ability to differ from the positions stated by the parties?
The resolution accountant can resolve earn-out disagreements in a way that's different from the position of the parties. He cannot resolve other issues that are not earn-out disagreements. And that is exactly what he said. I mean, Viacom has brought a claim under Section 10A3 of the Federal Arbitration Act. They didn't give you all the words of that section. It doesn't just say leaving out pertinent information. It says the arbitrators are guilty of misconduct in not considering pertinent information. So Congress didn't use one of the familiar standards of judicial review of an evidentiary ruling, like abuse of discretion or clear error or plain error. Congress chose this very high standard. The arbitrator must be guilty of misconduct. There are very few cases where that standard has ever been satisfied. Viacom only cites five cases in which courts actually overturned awards. And if you look at the cases, you'll see some pretty outrageous conduct. There's nothing remotely unfair about the process that occurred here. The resolution accountants told both sides before the hearing, we've got some concerns because we think both sides appear to be raising issues that go beyond what are the earn-out disagreements. What do you have to say about it? So they told us that they were concerned. They gave both sides an opportunity to comment in writing, and then they wrote a 10-page appendix explaining their reasoning. By no stretch of the imagination is that being guilty of misconduct. What Viacom is really concerned about, objecting to, in fact, that's what Mr. Atkins said, is they think that the resolution accountants misconstrued the contract. But that is not a permissible basis for review under the Federal Arbitration Act. The U.S. Supreme Court has made that very clear, and this Court has made it very clear that is not a permissible scope of review under 10A3. Now, Viacom tries to get around the guilty of misconduct standard by saying that this is an issue of substantive arbitrability and that that's not a question that arbitrators are allowed to resolve unless there's clear and unmistakable consent. Well, first of all, there was clear and unmistakable consent. Not in the agreement, I'm not saying it was in the agreement, but in the conduct of the parties. Because the law is crystal clear that if you believe that the arbitrators are going to decide an issue that is beyond their authority, you have to object during the course of the arbitration proceeding. You are not allowed to keep silent, hope that the arbitrators rule in your favor, but then if they rule against you, go into court and say, aha, the arbitrators lacked authority. The cases say that that is clear and unmistakable consent to have the arbitrators consider whatever issues that are submitted to them, whether you call it substantive arbitrability or anything else. If you submit it without objection, then the ruling is binding unless you come within the statutory standards of Section 10A3, because Section 9 of the Federal Arbitration Act says that the court must confirm the award unless it is vacated under Section 10 or Section 11. So there's no judicial discretion unless they can come within 10A3. But let me get to the question of whether this really was substantive arbitrability. Substantive arbitrability deals with the question of whether the underlying claim is one that the parties have agreed to arbitrate. And there's no question about that here. The underlying claim is the amount of the earnout. Both sides agree that that was a question that was for the arbitrators to decide. That being so, any issue about whether Viacom properly presented its write-down deduction, whether it timely presented it, whether it waived it, those are all questions of procedural arbitrability. I think this court made that rule very clear in the SPC Interactive case in affirming Vice Chancellor Jacobs when the court said that if the underlying dispute is arbitrable, then questions about whether particular claims can be brought or whether there are procedural defenses, questions such as notice and waiver, are all for the arbitrator to decide. So this is just not a question of procedural, this is not a question of substantive arbitrability. This is an issue, as the Chancellor found, where the substantive issue was clearly vested in the resolution accountants to decide. It was their job to decide the amount of the earnings.
The other side's position is this particular issue about the inventory write-downs was not decided.
And the resolution accountants gave their reasons why it was not decided. Their reasoning had two steps. Step one, under the merger agreement, we are only allowed to consider earn-out disagreements. And I don't think anybody has quarreled with that interpretation. And step two, this is not an earn-out disagreement because it was not presented in Viacom's earn-out statement. Viacom could have asked for it and didn't ask for it, and therefore it's not an earn-out statement and cannot be considered. Now, whether you think the resolution accountants decided that contractual question correctly or incorrectly is not an issue that can be considered. Just as if you thought that an arbitrator had incorrectly decided that a claim was untimely or that the procedures had not been followed, because those are questions that are vested in the arbitrator to decide and can be reviewed only if the arbitrators are guilty of misconduct and you can satisfy the very demanding standards of Section 10A3. Finally, I just want to make it clear why the arbitrators were correct. Let's say you decided that we're going to look at this issue de novo. The resolution accountants and the chancellor both said that they agreed that Viacom was not allowed to ask for an inventory write-down deduction under the terms of the contract because this is not an earn-out disagreement as defined in the contract. They had an opportunity to ask for an inventory write-down in their earn-out statement and chose not to do so. And, in fact, we know that that was a strategic choice not to do so because Viacom did not want to be coming in before the resolution accountants at BDO and presenting numbers which are contradicted by their audited financial statements in 10-K. Only at the end of the proceeding did they decide that they wanted to go into that direction. And it was also not an issue that we had teed up. We certainly did not quarrel with the factual presentation in Viacom's earn-out statement that there was no inventory write-down deduction. And I just want to dwell on that for a moment, because in order for Viacom to justify an inventory write-down deduction, assuming that they had presented it at the proper time, they would have to prevail on three issues. First is the factual question. Is the market value of the inventory on December 31st, 2008, below the cost? And that factual issue was never teed up until Viacom's reply brief in the proceeding before the resolution accountants. They never said that we have an issue in this case about the market value of the inventory. They never said that we have different numbers to present that don't look like the numbers that we included in our inventory schedule, that we want to contradict our own schedules. That was never presented. That's the factual issue. Second is the question of whether an inventory write-down is a direct variable cost. That issue never came up in the proceeding because Viacom hadn't asked for it. It didn't come up until we started to address it in our reply submission when it looked like they might be trying to expand the issues. And third, they would have to show that this inventory write-down deduction is a proper deduction for 2008. And the argument that we presented was an argument why it's not deductible in 2008. So all of these hurdles had to be confronted, and in order for them to be confronted properly, Viacom had to put it on the table, which they did not do. And so we believe the decision below should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Number one, I thought I heard, and it's consistent with the record, that the summary of issues, the controlling document, the document that framed the scope of the proceedings, put at issue, according to the stockholder representative, that no amount of cost associated with the inventory, unsold inventory, can be charged against revenue. Not 100% of it, nor the write-down. That was the issue they put in dispute. Those were the two issues we directly took on in response. We argued, one, yes, you should deduct 100% of the cost of making the unsold goods. We thought that's what the contract said. But if we're wrong about that, and you're right about matching, and they had put it at issue, then you should at least deduct the portion of the inventory write-down. That is, the cost associated with the impaired value of those goods because they would not sell in the future. They admitted it was in the summary of issue, and I think that is dispositive, and that's exactly the error that was committed by the court below. Number two, the assertion that the inventory write-down was not put in play by Viacom in its opening submission to the resolution accountants is false, and it is disproven in two respects. Number one, we did in fact mention it in our opening submission, but the proof is in the pudding, which is in response to our opening position, our opening submission, which supposedly didn't say anything about an inventory write-down, they wrote an entire section in reply to that on the merits, referring it to as Viacom's backup position. This is at pages A436 and 37 of the record. It is their reply submission to our opening submission. It has a section on the inventory write-down.
Could you identify the page that, as you say, puts the matter in issue?
Yes, that was page 27 of Viacom's submission. And it's quoted on page...
Do you know where it is in the appendix?
I'm going to get that in a second. It's page 27 of our opening submission. It's quoted by the stockholder's representative in his reply to it at A436. He calls it our backup position, even refers to it as net realizable value. That's accounting terminology for the inventory write-down. And then he goes on to argue on the merits two reasons why we're wrong. Not a word about it being improper, not a word about it being out of bounds, not a word about us not raising it, not a word about it being non-arbitrable, not a word, and this is important, about how the stockholders' representative was somehow deprived of discovery, because he wasn't. So how was it that the stockholders' representative was able to launch a full-bore merits response on an issue we supposedly didn't raise? The answer is we raised it, and it's because there was substantial discovery and disclosure even before the earnout statements. There was an electronic data room of 14,000 pages of documents, and it included in there our calculation of the inventory write-down. It included in there the backup spreadsheets, the Excel spreadsheets, computing the inventory write-down. So they had everything, and therefore were able to respond.
Counselor, yes, Your Honor. Time is up, but yes. could you give us the appendix page that Justice Berger requested?
It's A182.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.